You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of November 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck on today's show.
Les électeurs qui m'ont fait confiance sont naturellement...
The voters who put their trust in me are free to choose. Nevertheless, I will ask them to never take the path of the extreme. France deserves so much better than the choice of the worst.
La France mérite tellement mieux que le choix du pire.
As Nicolas Sarkozy crashes out of the French election early, my guests, Jane Kinnamont and James Rogers, will be asking what his right-leaning rivals had over him and whether it's the stuff that can beat Marine Le Pen too. Plus...
Bundeskanzlerin zu sein.
I will stand as a candidate for the office of the General Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany in the 2017 federal election.
Der Bundesrepublik Deutschland zu kandidieren.
Angela Merkel announces she'll run for re-election in Germany. We'll assess her chances and we'll also find out what Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin had to say to each other during their face-to-face meeting. All that plus a check-in on Obama's successors and a trip to the theatre too.
We, sir, we are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us.
Well, that's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. I should point out it's biblical rain here in London this evening, and it means that Jane Kinnaman, who's going to be joining us, I hope, later, hasn't quite made it to the studio. So we pulled in Steve Bloomfield, who's our executive editor and who knows all about these topics too. And of course, I'm joined by James Rogers, who's senior lecturer in journalism at City University in London. Welcome both to the programme. Next year's French presidential election race has already claimed its first major casualty. The country's former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, had been chasing a second go, but the centre-right candidate has crashed out of the running after this weekend's first-round vote saw him beaten by François Fillon and Alain Juppé, themselves both former prime ministers. Those two will battle it out this week to claim the centre-right candidacy. Well, James, I know you've covered an election with Marine Le Pen's father. You know the landscape. And that is, I guess, what we're looking for here, is somebody who can give Marine Le Pen a proper run for her money, because the risk is that she is looking like the only candidate from a very organised party.
She is, and of course, one gathers from things she said recently how very bolstered she feels about the two bloody noses which the political establishments on both sides of the Atlantic have already suffered this year, 2016, being the UK's vote to leave the European Union and, of course, Mr. Trump's victory in the United States. To put this into a little bit of French political historical context, it's remarkable that now we are talking with a degree of certainty that Ms. Le Pen will be in the second and final round of the election. If we go back to 2002, which I covered as a correspondent, it was a massive shock that her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, made it to the second round at all, and he was eventually defeated by the centre-right. The whole country, in fact, united around Jacques Chirac, who was duly re-elected as president. So I think a lot of people are wondering that it seems pretty much a certainty she'll be in the second round. Who's the candidate who can give her a run for her money?
I will say that Jane has eased through the monsoon. She's going to join us in a second. I'll let her catch her breath. Steve, when we look at the kind of the candidacy of Marine Le Pen, and I guess this is what we need to focus on, is there seems to be, it's gone from being an outsider. We've seen what's happened with Brexit. We've seen what happened with Trump. There's almost a kind of narrative building that is maybe kind of inevitable that she might win. Do you think that narrative being unfolded in the press may help her, that there is actually many regular French voters may be thinking, actually, why not? Maybe we need to do the same.
It might do. I think the big thing to think about here is less the rise of Marine Le Pen, but more the failure of the Socialist Party. François Hollande, the current president, has approval ratings of 5%, which, given that the margin of error in these things is 3%, which suggests that there aren't many people in France outside of his immediate family, perhaps not even them, who want him as their president. And Marine Le Pen can only get into the second round if one of the two main parties, the traditional centre-left and traditional centre-right, failed to do so. And François Hollande is, at the moment, has no chance whatsoever. So there is an inevitability at the moment of her reaching the second round. The issue then is, do we have a situation, as Jen was saying, back in 2002, when the rest of the country united around Jacques Chirac? 82% of voters voted for Jacques Chirac, whereas, you know, and just 18% for Jean-Marie Le Pen. Now, I don't think that's going to happen again this time. I think you're going to get a lot of voters, particularly those on the left, who will look at the economic policies of Marine Le Pen and think, you know what, actually, these are up my street. If it's a choice between her or particularly François Fillon, who is a classical free marketeer in the mould of Margaret Thatcher, they may well think, well, you know what, Marine Le Pen is going to be better for us than François Fillon, so therefore I'm voting for him. I'm voting for her, rather.
Jane, it certainly looks like Fillon and Juppé have been kind of moving their tanks towards her territory in a sense. You know, many of the things that they're talking about are, you know, we're going to extend the working week, we're going to kind of stop people retiring so early, which were many of the things which, you know, come through the socialist administrations. Do you think when they all line up next to each other, there's going to be a huge amount of difference in what they're presenting to the French electorate?
I think you'll certainly see some commonalities, as you say, and a tougher line on migration. Certainly already there's been a lot more normalisation of Islamophobic and nationalist to the point of chauvinist discourse in France, whoever wins. But I think there are still some major differences, especially when it comes to the question of whether France is going to stay in the European Union.
And James, when we look at France, so it's interesting. You know, obviously, Hollande isn't doing the kind of job at kind of leading the country that many people had hoped. So, you know, he will potentially crash and burn. But it's interesting. Just a few years ago, the country would vote for a socialist administration, and we're now at the point talking about would they vote for a far right administration? What's happened to France in 4 years that it would be such a kind of turnaround in outlook for a country like that?
I think it's principally economic concerns. I mean, I try to follow French politics in as much detail as I can, and if we look at some of the big electoral successes that the Front National, Marine Le Pen's party, has had over the last few years, it has been in those areas, rather like in this country, of the discussion about the left behind in the wake of the Brexit results, where traditional industries have gone away and nothing has come to replace them, and people just don't feel they've got any economic hope, and many of them blame globalisation, something of which Marine Le Pen has been an outspoken critic. And so I think she has a tremendous appeal in some of those areas among traditional left-wing voters, many of whom might have voted socialist and now, if they haven't already moved to the Front National, are considering doing so.
Steve, do you think that the terror attacks and the whether for rightfully or wrongfully, the interweaving of the narrative about migration, how important do you think that is going to be in this election? Because, in fact, Marine Le Pen certainly says more about that than Nicolas Sarkozy, in fact, was saying many quite strong things about it. It seems to be certainly part of the rest of the narrative for the other candidates, but not so strongly.
No, and let's not forget the context. And I think this is where it's a different situation from the US and from the UK. France has been in a state of emergency, for the best part of 12 months. There are armed police on the streets at times. There are you go through train stations on the TGV, and you'll see armed military personnel on station platforms. And so that then creates a very different atmosphere, one where actually people are talking about security. It's not an abstract thing. People are talking about their fears. And as you say, with Nicolas Sarkozy going so far to the right by talking about the need for a bikini ban and for the, we should not serve halal in schools, and if they won't eat our food, then they can just eat chips. This all helps to normalise Marine Le Pen, and actually then makes a lot of people think, well, actually what she's saying isn't quite as extreme.
We have a quote from Marine Le Pen at the weekend. She said, "I'm a patriotic candidate with Trump, with Theresa May, with Putin, and with the Visegrad group. I don't feel so isolated." She threw quite a few people into that cabinet, didn't she, Jane?
Yes, a difficult one for Theresa May to respond to either way.
But do you think that she is but a French Theresa May, or does she see herself as a French Putin?
She was one of the first people to congratulate Trump on Twitter before the American election results had actually come through. I think clearly she is aware that she's been trying to move the Front National more and more into the mainstream, and will now believe with Brexit and with Trump's victory that that is where she's at. She'll be trying to reach out to some voters who are the sort of people who probably aren't telling opinion pollsters that they're thinking of voting for the National Front, and trying to destigmatise that vote.
And just to add, sorry, Andrew, on Russia and Putin, let's not forget that Marine Le Pen's Front National asked Russia for a loan of €27 million to fight this election. Now, that's the sort of thing that in a normal circumstance you think it just sounds ridiculous, and the sort of thing that, you know, would be disqualifying in any normal year. I don't think it's going to be disqualifying in France, though, which is, you know, if you had a good opponent, a strong opponent who could take her on, that would be an issue I think they could push on.
Well, we're going to watch with interest, but we're going to head to Germany now, where Chancellor Angela Merkel is looking to run in the nation's own election next year. In power since 2005, her popularity has waned over the past few years thanks to her handling of the refugee crisis in Germany. But she's still seen as the voice of reason in Western politics, and with Europe currently rather in crisis, a vital leader for the bloc. James, do you think that she's going to retain enough popularity to win again?
Difficult to say, but certainly at this stage it would seem so. She's seen very much as a trusted pair of hands. She can stand on her record, and you're right, as you pointed out there, that her popularity has suffered somewhat as a result of her open-door refugee policy. But the opinion polls, if we still trust them in 2016, seem to give her a fairly solid lead at this stage. And she's also been a consummate politician, and she's been very good at putting together and holding together the grand coalition with which she's governed Germany. And there's probably every prospect of her doing that again. There are challenges to her popularity. There's this political insurgent party, the Alternative for Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, as it's called, which has heavily criticised her policy on immigration. But I think in a Europe which is a sea of political uncertainty, I think she's seen very much as a trusted pair of hands, both inside and outside the country, to a very large extent.
Jane, we're talking here earlier on about a kind of a weariness with old leaders, with Sarkozy gone, we've seen what's happened to Obama. Do you think that she does run some risk of that? There does seem to be a kind of a changing of the guard in most nations, a feeling that we are in different times, and that she could potentially look out of step as somebody who was at the, you know, at the vanguard of allowing the migration crisis to, you know, to be dealt with in a certain way, which is for many people was to encourage people to come on this kind of trail when there was often not much hope at the other end of it.
There's always a risk that politicians want to go on and on in office longer than they actually have the energy and fresh ideas to remain a leader. And there are certainly various factors that could pose a major risk to her. Could be a fascinating scenario if you had a France that started to look at pulling out of the European Union. What would that leave for Germany if everything was changing around it? But perhaps the fact that she does need to negotiate coalition politics has kept her in check and kept her needing to update and revise her politics in the way that sometimes a party leader who's really entrenched in power for a long time, like Tony Blair, doesn't have to do, because sometimes those leaders can become too complacent, too used to everyone around them saying yes.
You know, we've been saying that she's, you know, the person who kind of holds up now, the kind of, you know, the liberal values of Europe. Can I just ask you, Jen, when you look at what the narrative, what's going on around her, all these different countries, the feeling that everybody is slightly moving to the right, do you think that it is the case, that it's all kind of, you know, the same responses to the same situations? Or are we just seeing a coincidence of events where actually more local issues are often playing up? You know, here in the UK, it was very much around the Brexit vote that we saw the likes of Nigel Farage becoming more powerful. But do you think that, you know, that Germany is going to be subject to the same pressures? We were talking there about the ARD. There are many people in Germany are concerned about what happened around the migration movement. There are people who feel that, you know, that the country should be a little less staunch about its EU values.
There are certainly some things in common around the world in terms of concerns about rising inequality, concerns about globalisation that you mentioned. Pew Research has found all over the world, people tend to increasingly say that they feel that they don't have any control over their lives and that even their national politicians lack control. But at the same time, there are differences. Germany's economy is in a much better state than most in Europe. It doesn't have such severe youth unemployment issues. The business community, of course, has been quite in favour of Merkel's refugee policy, and they haven't had a major terrorism problem. They have had some isolated attacks, but so far that's not something that's really damaged, hit them at home.
And James, amazing. I hear that today there was a popularity poll, a poll that said, you know, that 55% of all Germans, not just her supporters, would still vote, would still like her to stay. Is that because, in the German context, she is seen as somebody who isn't shrill, who is logical about what she says, and, you know, is a calming influence among in these very difficult times?
I think it probably is. And also, as I say, in times of uncertainty, people may turn to her as somebody of a very much of a proven track record, not just, of course, in domestic affairs, but also in international affairs. You know, she has given real political leadership in a Western Europe, which has, to a large extent, lacked it over the last few years. And as Jane said, she raised the prospect possibly, of course, if there were a Marine Le Pen victory in the French elections, that France might eventually decide to leave the European Union. And there's a lot of ifs there, obviously. But in that sense, you know, the pressure would be on Germany all the more to see if it could hold the European Union together. One can, I suppose, have to conceive an EU without Britain now. An EU without France is a little harder to imagine.
But do you think, you know, Angela Merkel, you know, when Trump was elected, you know, she made it clear what her views were about that. But within the European context, you know, in you know, just 2 or 3 years ago, she could, you know, she may have been close to David Cameron, you know, she could rely on him to have a similar outlook to her. She knows that's not Theresa May anymore. She could call on Sarkozy. You know, they had a kind of a good working relationship. She knew all these characters, and they were much closer to her in their aspirations for the European Union, for starters. Do you think that she begins to look a little bit isolated if, you know, heaven forfend, but if Marine Le Pen was president in France, Theresa May in the UK, that she would lose her natural allies?
This is certainly exactly the kind of problem that can happen to a leader who's around for a long time. But against that, she is in charge of Europe's economic powerhouse. Theresa May needs to do a certain amount of posturing for the sake of her own party at home. At the end of the day, Theresa May was for remaining within the European Union, and she has a big incentive now to keep a decent relationship with Germany, because Germany is going to be critical to whatever kind of trade deal Britain ends up with. There would probably be more tensions with Marine Le Pen, but even still, there are a lot of French interest in not having a really hostile relationship with Germany, including if it wants to negotiate its way out of the European Union.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Jane Kinnamont and James Rogers. Coming up next, Obama meets Putin, perhaps for the very last time.
Hankering for a few ideas for the year ahead, or in mind of some reflection on the one that was? Monocle's mighty whacker of a December-January double issue is on newsstands now. What more could you want this festive season? Well, here's what our elfin editors have wrapped up for you.
In design, we get behind the green revolution that has sprung up in line with the growing popularity of the humble houseplant.
In the edit section, we stock up on stocking fillers in the Slovenian capital. From toys to books, clothes and a few well-designed delights, we present the finest presents from Ljubljana.
Monocle's Mammoth December-January double issue is on newsstands now. Pick up a copy today, or why not treat yourself to a subscription? Head to monocle.com to find out more.
You You're listening to Midori House. Still with me are Jane Kinnamont and James Rogers. A four-minute chat at the APEC summit in Lima, Peru at the weekend was likely to be US President Barack Obama and Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin's last ever meeting in person. The brief, courteous, but characteristically cold exchange was said to mention the future of Syria and Ukraine, and not a lot else, one imagines. Well, Jane, is Obama's difficulty in engaging with Vladimir Putin going to be something we remember him for in a way?
Absolutely. Obama came in with some big ambitions to build peace in the Middle East, peace with Iran, which he managed, peace with between Israel and the Palestinians, which he didn't manage. But the biggest criticism of him throughout the Middle East region is the failure to end the conflict in Syria, or worse, the decision initially to encourage the opposition to rise up and then to fail to really see that through. And Russia has ended up being the big strategic winner there.
So James, when he has his small conversation with Putin and says, you know, we need to do more to protect the civilians in Syria. We need to make sure that the agreed ways of pushing for, you know, a solution are followed. Mr. Putin's not really listening anymore, is he, in the last weeks of this administration?
No, I don't think he
is. If he ever was.
Well, I think he probably was once upon a time. But when, you know, you mentioned the sort of the coldness, one thinks of those photographs of the two of them sitting together like people, you know, rivals who've unwittingly found themselves on the same bench in the train or the same place in the waiting room, looking extremely uncomfortable. It's a very interesting moment in Russia-US relations, with Mr. Putin having expressed his admiration for Mr. Trump, and vice versa, of course. I mean, there's some dispute over whether Mr. Putin really said that Mr. Trump was bright. The word which he used in Russian was yarky, which could be translated as bright, but in the sense of bright red or bright green. In other words, it's often more translated as quite often more as colourful.
Okay.
A hairstyle comment.
Yeah, possibly. Bright yellow maybe is the better one.
Possibly. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I mean, Jane has hinted at the fact that Russia is now going to possibly find itself in the Middle East without having to take US interests into account to the same extent that it had. But there's a very interesting moment here in Russian domestic politics too, because a lot of Mr. Putin's new nationalism has been built upon blaming the United States for all the ills which are being suffered in Russia. For example, the economic circumstances as a result of the imposition of sanctions over Crimea. So one wonders what Mr. Putin does in domestic terms when he's got somebody for whom he has publicly expressed admiration in the White House.
Jane, do you think there's any sense in which Putin is waiting for Trump to come in and rubbing his hands with glee? You see, I would be cautious if I was Putin, because everything that Trump does, you know, he changes his mind every few minutes. You know, he's certainly determined for America to be seen as strong and powerful. You can't just quite guess what he would do, really, can you?
No, there are just a few things that have emerged consistently over the years from Trump, and one of them is his admiration for strongman figures. So, for instance, when Gorbachev was in power, Trump was actually very critical of him because he said Gorbachev was losing control over the Soviet Union. That happened to be an American interest, but wasn't the sign of a strong leader. So there is a kind of theoretical admiration for the strongman figure, regardless of democracy and human rights and so forth, that will certainly be appealing to Putin. But beyond that, it's very difficult to build up any clear picture of what the realities of policy would look like under Trump. It will become clearer as the various appointments shape up. But there's a big question about whether Russia and the US really have any more common interests than they did a few weeks ago.
James, what's your view on the future relationship between Russia and America?
Well, I think, you know, as you mentioned, in what the likely subjects for discussion between Presidents Obama and Putin were, it's going to depend a lot on Syria and Ukraine. It depends what the new administration's policies are going to be on those two issues. And given that we don't even know who the Secretary of State is going to be yet, that's a little hard to discern at this stage. One can see, and I think those of us who are trying to be optimistic about Syria a couple of years ago, there is clear potential common ground between the United States and Russia in Syria, being the defeat of ISIS. But so far, that is not something which has worked in terms of bringing them together, with, of course, Russia's apparent, at least short-term, aim of keeping Mr. Assad in power, something which the United States doesn't wish to countenance and doesn't wish to support. So I think a lot is going to depend really on those two key issues, because they, Ukraine, Crimea and Syria, have been the principal source of discord between the United States and Russia over the last few years.
Well, we're going to stay with Mr. Trump, because it's no secret that Barack Obama's incoming successor has a fondness for social media. But Trump's itchy trigger finger on the send button has showed no signs of slowing during his first 2 weeks as president-elect. In the past few days, he's singled out organisations ranging from the New York Times to the cast of Hamilton and Saturday Night Live. And he's also referred to candidates vying for top White House roles as finalists, as if he's still running the Apprentice game show. Well, let's hear a little of what the cast of Hamilton had to say about Trump's vice president, Mike Pence, last week before Trump responded, demanding an apology.
Vice President-elect Pence, we welcome you and we truly thank you for joining us here at Hamilton and American Musical. We really do. We, sir, we are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us, our planet, our children, our parents, or defend us and uphold our inalienable rights, sir. But we truly hope that this show has inspired you to uphold our American values and to work on behalf of all of us. All of us. This wonderful American story told by a diverse group of men, women of different colors, creeds, and orientations.
Jane, obviously Mr. Trump likes to respond. First of all, on the Hamilton thing, do you think it was right of the cast to make their opinions known?
It's something that Mike Pence said he didn't have any problem with.
I think they did it quite respectfully, actually, because they did say, you know, we don't want you to be booed, we want you to hear our views.
Yeah, this was an interesting moment. Everyone had gone to see a play about an American leader and American leadership, and taking the opportunity to have a conversation that connects to current day politics is an interesting one. But it's fascinating that Pence himself didn't want to raise any objections to it. However he really felt about it, he clearly thought that objecting would seem petty and small-minded, and yet the president-elect didn't take the same view.
The use of Twitter by a president-elect, James, do you think it's a bit peculiar that he still is so fond of sending out messages? You know, and they really are his messages. It's not like he's got a social media team who are kind of moulding and polishing everything before he sends them.
Yes, I wonder who the finalists are for that position if it should become available in Mr. Trump's cabinet. I mean, I think, you know, he has, whatever one thinks of him, there is no question that part of the success of his campaign lies in his great understanding of the medium of television and his very effective use of social media. So I suppose he sees no reason to stop that now. But I mean, I think what has concerned some of his critics, and, you know, picking up on what Jane said, that one understands some reports saying that Mr. Pence actually said to those family members who were with him, well, that's free speech in action. That's what America's supposed to be about. Mr. Trump doesn't seem to have seen it that way. He's been pretty critical of it. And I think his critics, they in turn are very concerned about what this says for free speech. He's had a swipe at the New York Times, which was very critical of him in some of his reporting of his campaign. So I think a lot of people are wondering, this, after all, a country where, as in many countries, free speech is enshrined in the Constitution, but where, as in not every country, the Americans really do seem to mean it. And if there's any threat to that, I think it could lead to some very interesting clashes in the future. But I can't see Mr. Trump giving up social media anytime soon, certainly not before his inauguration.
Well, he's used it so well to kind of create false stories, to undermine people, to, you know, whether it's the birth movement or whatever. But maybe one of his failures is trying to criticise Saturday Night Live, because actually it never looks good if you're grumpy about someone being, you know, spoofing of you, Jane.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Jokes are very hard to respond to. At the same time, I think by sounding off about Saturday Night Live and about Hamilton, Trump has been able to maintain the kind of persona that he's built up right through the election campaign without really incurring any costs. I think those who have criticised him generally were already his critics, and he's picked targets that, you know, he can offend without particularly damaging key constituencies.
And he's probably helped sell quite a lot of tickets, I think, for Hamilton, and made sure that lots more people around the world watch Saturday Night Live.
So first intention.
So maybe we should thank him for that. But I'd like to thank, first of all, Jane Kinnamon and James Rogers for joining us here today on Midori House, because that's all we have time for. The show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Acosta Pacheco, and also Jake Fitzsimmons and Gal Barnea, and also Beatrice Carmi. Our studio manager, well, that was Toby Hammond. More music next, but from me, Andrew Tuck, just a chance to say thank you very much for joining us today, and goodbye.